May I ask you something?
I can't promise I'll answer.
Right. That's exactly what I meant. Are you allowed to speak along the way? I was thinking there might be rules.
Well, let me put it this way. Very few make it all the way without uttering a word. But do carry on merrily. Just don't believe you are going to tell me something I haven't heard before.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of The House That Jack Built.
If you feel like screaming, I definitely think that you should.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Sean Ray.
If you ask me, I'd say that this needs to be thoroughly investigated.
Hosted by Arnie.
Mr. Sophistication, of course.
Stuart.
I'm kind of glad that you're the one that caught me.
And Jacob.
I feel like my observations, well, they could be of use in an investigation.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
I wouldn't recommend it, but the choice is entirely yours.
Listener discretion is advised.
I want to know everything.
Today we are entering The House That Jack Built, starring Matt Dillon. Directed by Lars von Trier. This is Arnie, the noble rot of Now Playing.
And Stuart.
And this is the host who's way too much of a wimp to murder anyone, Jacob.
You know, I am always appreciative that there are people out in the world willing to pay money to hear us talk about movies, but I am particularly excited we have an October patron that is getting us here today to talk about a movie and a director that in all likelihood we would never cover on the main feed.
No Von Trier retrospective coming up?
I don't see that on the donation feed either, Stuart.
Yeah, look, to be clear, Now Playing is the house that Jason, Freddy, and Michael built. We love us some slashers. I mean, it was marketed. It should be said the house that Jack built was marketed to Americans as some kind of extreme horror experience for gore hounds. If you loved Human Centipede, you're going to love this. But,
Yeah, no, I remember hearing stories at cons that people walked out. It was so violent and horrific and child murder. Like, I had to see it with that kind of press.
We're recording this and releasing this in October. I'm trying to watch a movie a day, a horror movie a day for Halloween. iTunes has The House That Jack Built under horror. I'm like, all right, well, this is going to be my one for today. Man, did I feel a little blue-balled.
To me, here's the thing. Yes, this movie has very little to do with serial killers. It has everything to do with Lars von Trier, which I'm going to go on record here as someone that has been an inspiration to me for decades. He, like, when I wanted to go to film school, like, his work was what I was thinking about. I've followed him closely throughout my career. He never fails this. I'm not saying I love all his work, but he never fails to provoke a very heated debate in film circles. People always react strongly to his work. And yeah, I'm just so excited to be able to put some of those strong thoughts onto a podcast. So that's why you picked him, Sean, right? You love von Trier too?
Yeah, let's just say Sean Ray is back with us. He's the one who picked the film.
I do love Lars von Trier, yeah. Probably not the same way you do, though, Stuart.
You prefaced it. You told me. I'm prepared.
Maybe infamously, I pledged for you guys to review Face Off. And yeah, we all knew that Stuart wasn't going to like that film. But, you know, in that review, Stuart was like, oh, yeah, it took me 10 hours to watch this. And I swear this is the truth. I'm not just saying this because I picked that movie. I swear. The first time I sat down to watch The House That Jack Built, this film took me 5 hours to watch once. I had to rewatch every scene.
Yeah, that's twice. It's a 2.5 hour film.
I did. I'm like, so, I mean, for problem number one, right? This movie's about 5 incidents over a 12-year period. I'm going to select them at random. That's not how storytelling works. Like, you look at other serial killer movies. I think of, like, Seven or, like, Zodiac. Like, at least you could follow what they're doing and understand that they have some sort of manifesto. Not that I, of course, agree with it. But, like, what kind of storytelling is about randomness?
So you're saying you have major problems with the film. Is that just this film, or is it all von Trier?
It's all, yeah. No, I almost picked Dancer in the Dark, like I said last month.
Underrated in the book. Love it.
Sean, I have to ask the question that's on everybody's mind. To pick a movie for us to review is a large pledge. And, you know, it takes us a lot of time to watch, research, record. That's why it's the number it is. But I'm positive 99% of our listeners are thinking, why would you spend that money to hear us talk about this movie that you despise?
Yeah, what if we all glowingly endorse it and it all backfires?
I love this movie, but I don't like it for the same reason his fans love it for.
So it's a brown arrow for you, is what you're saying.
Like, this is absolutely pitch perfect. Like, put it on the shelf next to Color of Night and all that other stuff that y'all have reviewed. Yeah, absolutely. Brown arrow all the way. Like, I can't believe that someone funded this film after reading the script. You know, Oscar-nominated actresses read their parts who don't even have names and is like, signs up for this. I mean, what is going on? Like, what is in this script? Look, I want to be a filmmaker. I'm all for people expressing their vision. I just don't understand what is here for people to enjoy. And I'm not even talking about the violence of it. I just like, what is the thematic tie or the, like, what is it? Like, what do people like about this filmmaker?
All right, Sean, then I feel like I can be here for you because like I said, already put it out there. Heated debates. I've never met anyone that was blasé about the man's work. And I've met many people. Sean's not the first person I know that detest and just literally, see, I don't even know, Sean, if it's personal. I know some people that actually feel like the man himself is terrible.
I mean, he was banned from Cannes for making, like, I don't know, pro-Nazi or sympathetic statements. I don't remember the whole controversy, but
I followed it all. So here's what I can do for you. I can do this much for you, Sean. I can explain to you what I find appealing about his work. Not necessarily this film, but I do feel like I understand this film. I really feel like I connect with what this film is.
I just want to be clear on something. Like, I don't in any way, like, I hate censorship. I'm not here to picket Lars von Trier. I don't have to watch the movies. But make whatever the hell you want. You know what I mean? I just, like, what is it that people like? First off, let's start with this. What genre of film is this? Is this horror? Because I'm laughing throughout a lot of this.
To me, this would probably make a double feature with American Psycho. It is a dark comedy that uses extreme violence and sort of crude, tasteless humor, largely at the expense of women, to make a lowbrow kind of, I don't know, it's American Psycho horror. To me, it's horrific, but more just like black comedy, basically.
Okay, but Stuart, you mentioned on, I think, The Room, you talked that Tech One class, and you tried to help emerging filmmakers kind of find their voice in that class. What kind of, like, storytelling device is it that you pick random events to, like he's selecting incidents at random, he tells us.
I don't think that it is, but I agree that that's what the character says. So, again, I don't see the movie's choices as random at all. And, again, want to just put it out there, steeped in the man's work. So much so that I recognize fully. Right now, I could make this the longest recording in Now Playing History talking all Lars. I'm going to refrain from that. I did create a list of 5 things that I think it's helpful to know, because I imagine many people listening out there don't even know who the hell this guy is, never seen another one of his films. Things you might want to know that will put this movie into some kind of context.
I might owe an apology to the patrons. They're diving in the deep end of his filmography.
It's a really strange place to start. This is not how I would begin. And I would just put it out there that the films that made me the big fan of him, he made 30, 35 years ago. For me, it was Zentropa, Kingdom, and Breaking the Waves.
And see, for me, I have not gone back to his early stuff. I kind of found out who von Trier was because of Dance from the Dark. I'm like, oh, Bjork's in a movie? I want to see that. I like Bjork. And then, yeah, I learned about this director. I've seen his movies going forward, but I have not gone back to his early stuff, which I've heard is much more art house, like much more experimental.
And I'm coming in as the newbie here. You know, we have usually the fan, the medium person, and the newbie. I think we know who's who. I have really seen only a couple of things of Lars von Trier, but until a couple weeks ago, I'd say I was a fan because Stuart introduced me to one of the coolest TV shows I'd ever seen. It was done by some Danish filmmaker I'd never heard of, but the TV show Kingdom. We binge watched it before binge watching was a thing. Stuart had it all on VHS.
It is a better season of Twin Peaks than what David Lynch gave us. I want to say for all of those that felt like it never got better in Twin Peaks than the first 8 episodes, Kingdom is the spiritual sequel. It's set in this hospital where, like, people give birth to babies with fully developed human heads and ghosts and what have you. If you like Twin Peaks, I think you would like this show.
It was laugh out loud funny, and it had good horror. The second season didn't live up to the first, kind of Twin Peaks-y in that way, but I have always enjoyed that, and for Americans who've never heard of it, you might have heard Stephen King had a TV series called Kingdom Hospital. King tried to remake that for the States, and not nearly as good. But that's all I knew of Lars von Trier until Dancer in the Dark in the book. I tried watching that. I'm fortunately not on that review, so I was able to leave the room and not finish that piece of crap film that I could not stand.
That's amazing. I almost picked it.
Oh, my God.
Great film. Great film, you mean.
Oh, that is so painful. I'm not a fan of Bjork on the best day, and that was the worst day.
And just to put it out there, part of the reason why that movie was very exciting to me is Bjork is my favorite singer, so pop artist. The fact that those two were getting together to make a movie was just...
It's like peanut butter and chocolate for you.
It was amazing. Like, yeah, the fact that they got together. And then, of course, the stories that came out of that shoot are legendary. And again, I wish I could go through and walk you through all of the great Lars stories, because love him or hate him, he just has a very colorful history full of scandal. And that was the first point I think it's helpful to contextualize, is that you may never have heard of Lars von Trier, but he has been working for almost 40 years, and almost every one of his films is considered controversial or has some scandal, sometimes created in the way that he presents it at the Cannes Film Festival. Many times, I think the message of the movie gets clouded by some stunt he pulls when he's walking the red carpet. From his very first film, he showed up as a skinhead talking about like German philosophy, and the French thought he was a neo-Nazi. And then, of course, it didn't help that decades later, he actually said he was a Nazi in jest, and that he understood why Hitler did what he did.
I mean, he's going to praise, yeah, a lot of stuff about Nazis and the philosophy of rot in this film. Like, he brings it on. I think it's something he does want.
Yeah. And so the second point I want to make is Lars von Trier is not a Nazi. It's really important to realize, whatever you think about him, his parents fought in World War II. They were freedom fighters that defended Denmark from Nazi occupation. It's personal for him. He actually grew up believing that he was Jewish until his mother told him on her deathbed that the father that he thought he had was not his biological father and he wasn't Jewish at all, and really screwed him up. But he is not a Nazi sympathizer or a white supremacist or any of those things. He is maybe at worst a man that invented the art of trolling and has said things like this that have got him into a lot of hot water.
I mean, I get it. Sid Vicious would wear swastikas on his t-shirt back in the day of the Sex Pistols just to provoke people.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know what punk rock is, and Lars was very much punk rock then and even now, although punk in old age doesn't look as cool as punk in youth.
Yes.
And so the third point I think is important to understand is that Lars has obviously a lot of problems with authority, starting with his parents. Again, they lied to him about who his father was. His mother was a militant atheist. And he, like, even as a young child tucking him in, she said, "There's no heaven if you die tonight, and you could die tonight." And again, this riddled him with all kinds of anxiety. So as a young man, his rebellion was actually to go to religious dogma.
Did he join a monastery, become a monk?
Well, he did create like a whole cinematic movement, Dogma 95, that was out to teach film purity. And he converted to Catholicism for a while. And I think his movies, they have these ridiculous plot twists in it. And, you know, nobody should be able to buy some of the premises that he puts forth. But I think that that's Lars's dare. It's like, I know you don't believe this logically, but can I make you, like an act of faith, believe in it because the emotions are so intense? Because I make these melodramas that are just so overwhelming that you'll cry, even though it's patently ridiculous. Dancer in the Dark is a film that I think is absolutely stupid on its face, but is an incredibly moving experience if you give yourself to it.
I half agree.
Totally. And I felt the same way with Melancholia, which is about like a ghost planet showing up to crash into Earth. And it's very ridiculous sci-fi, but it's all about the emotion and the exploration of depression. And that wins me over with that film.
I did watch Melancholia as a way to prep for this, and I would give that a recommend. So there is that.
It's my second favorite of his films. I do love that film. It's the only film of his later period that I think lives up to his early period.
Well, I have to ask, and I'm just curious. I'm just trying to understand. I mean, I've heard all of you complain about digital filmmaking throughout Now Playing's history. I mean, this man founded it with Dogma 95. I mean, Dancer in the Dark is one of the ugliest films I've ever seen.
Oh, I agree.
It is. It really is. It's one thing I really don't like about the film. He had a lot. Again, I wish we could just cover that film so I could tell you the hours of thoughts that I have on it. But yes, here's another thing about Lars. I didn't include it in the list, but we'll make it number 6. Lars likes to challenge himself with technical innovation, and he will try things that probably will blow up in his face. He made one film in which he actually artificially programmed a camera to make the editing choices, and he couldn't actually tell what was going to be on screen or not. And you have lots of cuts off heads or things looking in the wrong direction while people are talking and what have you. Dancer in the Dark is definitely a film where I don't feel like the technical choices serve the idea of a musical. But another point about Lars, just in general to understand his work, is he tends to think in film trilogies, and he tends to focus on a female character that's going to suffer greatly.
Yeah, is it misogyny thrown his way a lot?
Yeah, because of that, many critics have labeled him a sadist. They say that he gets some cruel perversion out of seeing women tortured. And I think that theory is bolstered by things that have happened on his sets. Yes, Bjork has Me Too'd him, and Nicole Kidman also talks about having PTSD after working with him on Dogville. She's in a bad place. She had just been kicked to the curb by Tom Cruise. She went to Lars von Trier. That's like frying pan into blazing furnace. I can't imagine how damaged she was after going through that experience.
Yeah, I heard Kirsten Dunst, who was the star of Melancholia, turned down a role for this one. So I don't know what her experience was, but she wasn't coming back.
But I always think he gets incredible performances from these actresses. It can't be fun to live through the production, but I think in most cases, Emily Watson in Breaking the Waves is one of my favorite performances by any actor ever. Like, I just think that he can really take people that not necessarily aren't even trained and bring something authentic and real to a story that might otherwise feel completely phony. And Charlotte Gainsbourg, who has done a lot of his recent work, has said many times that Lars is his women, that you think that he's being cruel to his women, but in fact, Lars feels tortured himself. The final point to understand about Lars is he has a long history of mental illness. Starting with the abuse that he took from his parents as a kid, he developed all these phobias. He actually won't get on an airplane. He's never been to America. He's made this film about America. He's never been there, will never be there. He sometimes doesn't show up for film festivals because he doesn't even want to get into the car. He has social anxiety. He'll have panic attacks. He wouldn't meet David Lynch because too many people were in the room. And so he just walked out and ran away. And for the last 12 years, he's actually been so clinically depressed, he didn't think that he could make a movie again. He didn't think he could show up on a film set. And so what he did was he wrote a trilogy of films that he hoped would cure his depression. And those films are Antichrist, Melancholia, Nymphomaniac.
Yeah, real uppers.
Yeah, like Antichrist to me feels like an exercise in free association.
Oh, I love that film. There's a horror film to watch for Halloween.
Melancholia is very much like, imagine the worst thing possible happening to you. It's there in that film. I can't think of anything worse, actually.
You mean changing your mind on your wedding day? I mean, that is pretty bad.
Well, it starts that way. Yeah, it starts as Alanis Morissette, and then it ends with, like, destruction of all life in the universe. And then Nymphomaniac, to me...
Guys, not as sexy as it sounds.
Much like this film, it's an autobiography of Lars.
It really isn't as sexy as it sounds. I watched half of the first part, and I'm like, no. But I do see a lot of parallels to the house that Jack built. I mean, the structurally, they seem the same.
Yes. What Lars is doing in Nymphomaniac is he's saying, here's my career as a series of wild sex acts. And you can see in individual scenes, if you're a fan of his work, oh, you're recreating something you did in a previous movie, and why can't I get it up anymore? Like the character, the nymphomaniac, stops enjoying sex. That was where he was at with filmmaking. These films did not cure his depression. He was sober. He fell off the wagon. And in the making of this movie, I feel like we're seeing Lars at his very worst, psychologically speaking.
And one of my questions for you, Stuart, with this, and I guess you would be able to expand more on this on the 16-hour version of this podcast where you go over every little scene.
Right. I'm trying not to, guys, but I geek out at this. I can't help it.
Yeah. Overall, these five incidents, and you know, we'll get into it in the film, but this is a film about art, and I did see each incident as a process and a growing artist and in their life cycle. Is there like a one-for-one that he's talking about his own career? He's going to show clips of his own movies in this film, but is there a deeper revelation, like where incident one is about something early on in his career? Does it go that deep?
I think there is codes like that, and it's part of the fun of a fan is decoding that. That certainly for me was what Nymphomaniac was about, of going, oh, this scene is actually Manderley, and you know, like you can actually see because someone wears the same outfit or says a line from another film, you're going, ah, you're recreating that moment. Yes. This is an artist at the end of his career. Lars says, I am never making another film again, and this is me assessing why I didn't build my house, why I'm not the great filmmaker I always champion myself in my egotistical moments of being. And so you're having a lot of self-hate in this film. You're having a lot of reflection on failure and looking at the artistic process as a series of death and murder. Now, which version did you guys see? There are two cuts. The unrated, essentially, you're going to see breasts be removed. You're going to see children be shot in the head.
I saw the unrated then.
I, too, saw the unrated. I did see there were two versions available for me to get. And I knew Lars von Trier, the unrated wasn't going to be some studio producer came in and added more scenes to sell more DVDs.
Yeah, it's 90 seconds longer, and I think it's because they actually show, like, what bullets do to kids when they hit them.
Yeah, I knew that this would just be an MPAA-censored version, which I never want to see. Burn the MPAA down, I say. So I saw the full child-killing, tit-cutting version.
Yeah, I think I saw the rated version when this came out. I think where I streamed it from, because again, no theater in Springfield would play this, but you could rent it. I think the rated was all that I could get from Comcast. So I saw it in that rated form. This movie, this time, seeing it, this is my second time seeing this film 2 years later. It did feel like some of those moments hit a little bit harder with that violence, with that unrated cut. But that's about it. So Arnie, why don't you give him the plot and we will walk into this house that Jack and Lars built.
Matt Dillon plays Jack, a serial killer being escorted to hell by the historical Greek poet Virgil, or Verge as he likes to informally be called, played by Bruno Ganz. As the two trek through the blackness, Jack revels in telling Verge about five of the many murders he's committed, from girlfriends to random strangers on the side of the road. He then takes each body and stores it in a meat freezer he owns. He poses the bodies in different ways, which amuses him. By day, Jack is an engineer, but he wanted to be an architect. He inherited a sum of money and is using it to prove he can be an architect by designing and building his own house. But each time Jack gets his house started, he finds it unsatisfying and tears it down to start over. Finally, the authorities catch on to Jack, but not for anything he's actually done. They believe he's a man wanted for armed robbery. Jack hides in the meat freezer as the authorities make their way in, which is when Verge appears to Jack. At Verge's urging, Jack finally builds his house out of the corpses he's kept in the freezer, and he steps into the house, which is the entry to hell. Verge takes him to the bottom rung of hell, the one place where there's a possible escape if Jack can rock climb across a wide crevice. Jack tries and falls into the abyss as credits roll.
Okay, let's start with the title. I think that's a good place to begin. The house that Jack built, you may or may not realize, I did not when I saw the film, it is a reference to an old nursery rhyme.
Is that what he's going for? Because I noticed in the end credits, special thanks to Lars Ulrich.
The Metallica's drummer?
Yes, Metallica has a song from one of their 90s albums called The House That Jack Built.
Yeah, I think Lars, again, he liked metal, speed metal, and Metallica and all of that. So that may just be because he thought he was cool. But yeah, a good catch on that. But for those that don't know, it has nothing to do with Jack Spratt eating no fat. It has nothing to do with Jack and Jill going up a hill or Jack climbing a beanstalk. You actually never find out what Jack is doing in the house. It is a rhyme about digressions. It is a little nursery rhyme about the inner relationship between a bunch of random things, like a cow that uses its broken horn to throw a dog, that troubled a cat, that killed a rat, that ate the cheese, that lay in the house that Jack built. And then you go back and something happens to the cow and you keep adding more and more, kind of like the 12 Days of Christmas.
Or what it reminded me of, one of my favorites from elementary school, the same kind of structure is the little old woman who swallowed a fly. And, you know, she ate a fly and then she eats a spider to get rid of the fly. Then she has to eat a bird to get rid of the spider. And like by the end, I think she's eating a hippopotamus. It's just this absurdity where it just, yeah, keeps expanding and grows more and more absurd as it goes along.
Sadly, the daisy chain never reaches Kevin Bacon. I would have thought he would get in there by the sixth verse. But what does this mean in context of the movie? I think there are two meanings. One, you could look at this as the end product of Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper is obviously the most notorious serial killer of all time. He's sort of started the idea of what a serial killer is. And so he laid that house foundation, and from there, rooms dedicated to the talented Mr. Ripley and Hannibal Lecter and Dexter all grew until we've now reached this point in this room in the serial killer genre. But I also think it's important to point out, as I've already said, that Lars is doing a lot of self-referencing. And his first movie, The Element of Crime, is a serial killer movie. It is set in a post-apocalyptic Europe where this police detective is using weird methods to find a child killer. And he comes across a prostitute in one scene that recites the nursery rhyme, The House That Jack Built. So he is, starting with this title, beginning with the beginning of his career. And so I really do take it to mean like this is Lars looking at his body of work, the house of horrors that he built. And again, the fact that it's not complete and that he's a frustrated artist, or rather Jack, the character, is a frustrated artist that keeps tearing it down, sort of tells you the emotional state of Lars as he's looking back on his career. And we also have this frame story, which is a device Lars uses a lot, in which for a while we don't realize it, but the killer is condemned to hell and telling us all of this on his walk with, yeah, the Roman poet Virgil, who did this with Dante in Inferno.
We're not supposed to know from the very first frame he's being walked to hell, because you get a guy with a foreign accent who sounds a little bit like, if you could squint your ears, I would think this is Max von Sydow talking. I knew from the very beginning, all right, this guy is going to hell, especially with the dialogue being said. Can I ask questions? It's a long journey. They all do.
I don't think he's trying to keep it a secret. It's pretty obvious if you know your classical literature.
Yeah, but he's called Verge. And again, it's all in darkness. And you may be just getting there and sitting down and munching on your popcorn and not totally paying attention that the movie started.
That's what I think of with Lars von Trier. I always want a good bucket of popcorn.
And you know what? Both Nymphomaniac Volume 1 and this has 2 minutes of blackness before the movie starts. So I think that's when you're supposed to get your seat and munch your popcorn. He gives you plenty of black screen to stare at before you get to the actual first frame.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm happy to be wrong, but I think audiences may not realize really what's going on yet. They're not going to kick in until we get to the chapters. And this is classic structure. Lars has always been very novelistic. I think 90% of his movies are built around chapters or incidents or just moments in time that he isolates, like a book. And so we get incident one, which I think is the very first kill that Jack ever does. He looks like he's about 35 years old. So he's no Ted Bundy here. He didn't start early. He is killing Uma Thurman after having, I guess, a long career as an architect or an engineer.
Yeah, not an architect. He has a chip on his shoulder that he is not an architect. He says he's an architect. He didn't quite make that. And I wondered if this was his first kill. I did watch a trailer before watching this. I knew this was a movie of Matt Dillon as a serial killer. So when this woman goes on and on and on about he could be a serial killer, I'm thinking, okay, well, this is ironic, but she goes on about it so far to the point that she says, you're too big of a wuss to be a serial killer. I truthfully wondered if this was like one of those fantasy situations where he hired someone in advance, like a prostitute, to talk about serial killing and pretend to be broken down.
You thought this was a big role play?
I did. I thought this was all a role play scenario because of all the talk of serial killing.
I did like the dark comedy that they meet because of a Jack, and this is a Jack, and he's going to kill her with a Jack. Again, maybe that's a little juvenile, but I do feel like because this is, sure, it's a film about serial killers, but it's also a film about process, about art and how it's made and all that. And yes, here's your first step. Maybe it's accidental. Like maybe he had these tendencies and it was almost done on a dare to get back at someone that doubted him. Like, so he finally goes through it. And that's how I see this first kill is, here's this woman just tormenting him. And, you know, at first, you're a serial killer. No, you're a wimp. And he finally snaps and does it. And it's dirty. It's not thought out very well, just like a student film.
But while this is the first body he definitely takes to this freezer he bought some shut down pizza place and has a meat locker there.
I like that he tried to sell the pizzas, but they're horrible. So they're just sitting there.
But we get to see much later on in a flashback him as a young child cutting a leg off of a baby duck. And again, we've talked about this many times. That's the hallmark of serial killers is they start with animals. I can't imagine he cut a leg off a baby duck, then 30 years later he kills Uma Thurman. I have to feel like there's something in between those two that happened.
Not to mention Matt Dillon is 53 when he's filming this movie. He's always looked young. I know he was the teen heartthrob, but he is not looking young anymore. And it is.
Yeah, I don't get that this takes place over 12 years. He looks the same old age throughout the film.
Correct. And we never see the process by which he goes from being that small child into being a fully fledged. It's not a methodology movie. We can't understand this as a serial killer movie. So it's very entertaining to hear you guys talking to me about how this works as the story of Jack. Because again, I can only watch this movie as the story of Lars. And I feel like what Lars is saying here is that I am not a misogynist. I didn't start out hating women. I killed my first woman because the social criticism wouldn't leave me alone. They kept saying, you're a killer, you're an awful person, you're this misogynist. And so I started taking the bait and making more and more outrageous things happen to women characters in my movie. And the pizzeria, again, that feels very much like, yeah, I could have been a commercial filmmaker. Never forget that Madonna came to him. She wanted him to do the erotica videos. Udo Kier, his longtime collaborator, ended up doing it. But Lars is like, I don't want to work with commercial people.
So Madonna is bad tasting pizza.
Yes. And everything she represents is something that Lars and Jack just won't serve. And so he's got this high-minded sense about being an artist. And we see that. When he kills Uma, he looks at his hands, and what does he think about? He thinks about Glenn Gould playing the piano, or architecture in cathedrals, or painting, cubist works, and what have you. He is immediately identifying the character as an artist, and that murderer is art.
And at that moment, it hit me over the head. This is going to be an autobiographical kind of work where, yes, murder is art and pretension is dripping.
Yeah, no, pretension's always dripping in his films. My thought is maybe cut all your lectures and your thoughts and make this a more ambiguous film with the story and let us come to those conclusions. I do feel like I'm listening to a professor lecture me on the history of art.
This is a relatively new style for Lars. I saw him do this in Nymphomaniac. But really, before that, he would never digress and show stock footage of lions attacking lambs. And all of the cutaway found footage stuff that he inserts here feels like he's working with a new collaborator, which he is. And believe it or not, it's a woman. He actually is partnered to write this story. He originally conceived it as a TV series, believe it or not, where each episode was Jack killing someone. But she was the one that convinced him, let's look at this as you reflecting on the attacks of misogyny, and I'll help you shape the story in that way. So I think that some of this language is another voice helping Lars along. Lars of 10 years ago would not have made the film this way.
Yeah, I did read that he gave himself time to like actually edit scenes while still shooting, something he had never done, so he could kind of see how the film was forming as he was still producing it.
Yeah, he also, just want to throw it out there, was drinking heavily and blacking out, and maybe they had to stop production because he was not functioning?
That's the real reason, okay.
I kind of believe that. Looking at the end result of this movie, again, I see a filmmaker that is not up to his best work by far. I'll just leave it at that. But definitely one that is trying to connect with what he has done in the past and to make a crude joke out of his bad reputation. okay, I'm a serial killer. I hate women. I do horrible things. Let me play into that. But he is actually trying to build a house. I do think it's kind of quirky that we do find out. It's almost an afterthought, but in the middle of all of this, it's just mentioned that he bought a plot of land by Mount St. Helens and is hoping to use his inheritance to actually build something great.
This is supposed to be in America, right? Because that's always something that confuses me with von Trier films. Like, even Dance from the Dark, eventually I go, oh, okay, this is in the States. Like, nothing looks like the States, though, because I guess he's too afraid to come over here, or at least travel over here.
Yeah, nothing here told me that I was in the United States. And when he mentioned Mount St. Helens, that was like a rah kind of moment, because so many of the people he interacts with have accents too. This feels like a foreign film. I don't mean to be this disparaging, but I think about like the later Tremors or Hellraiser sequels where they had to film in Romania and pretend it was the States and you get all these people with accents. That was kind of what was coming to mind as this fake America. But this is far better than any of those.
Yeah, it is a fake America. Again, Lars won't come here. He's also done a lot of writing about how America has colonized the minds of the world. And so that everywhere is America. He'll write a lot about that. It's an interesting notion. And so he's done a lot of... He had a whole trilogy he didn't complete, spiraling into depression. But he had an anti-American trilogy with Dogville and Manderley. So America is an easy target for him, and because he can't go there, they've changed some license plates on some obvious foreign cars and tried to say we're in Washington State between 1970 and Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. So the 12 years would be between the late 60s and the early 80s that we're in. So next incident, this is where we really see how Jack has some psychological defects. He's got OCD.
Yes. And I think this incident is pretty funny. Like, okay, let's start at the beginning. He knocks on a woman's door. I don't know how he's chosen this victim, but he's going to pretend to be a police officer. And then when he can't produce a badge, an insurance salesman. Like, do we know how he knows this person? Or is this a, like, he knows about her husband a little bit. Is she totally random?
I think this might be the second kill. Again, if this were a more formally structured movie telling you the story of a serial killer, you would have attention to these details. This is an actress that Lars von Trier has worked with before. She also used to be on SNL.
Yeah, we talked about her in Men in Black.
No, I don't remember her as a comedy actress, but she has done various bits in Lars' world. And here, the joke is that she thinks that she can get a double on her dead husband's pension. So he's going to try to figure out how long it takes to choke someone and keeps getting the timing wrong.
Yeah, I actually really liked that about this film is if you watch Hollywood movies, you might be tempted to think I could grab that pillow and smother my spouse in 30, 45 seconds of struggling. No, it takes forever to kill somebody with a pillow. Strangulation is a slow death. So I actually really loved that he thought he strangled her. She was still alive. He'd crushed something.
Yeah, you just cut the blood off to her brain and she passed out and then she comes to.
Yeah, and he may have crushed her larynx or damaged her throat in some way. I mean, that's a lot of pressure to put on a throat. It will cause damage. But that she comes back and requires more work to strangle. And eventually he just stabs her, which I think is kind of a cheat. I mean, you want to learn to strangle, strangle. You know, maybe I'm taking too much of an American Psycho view of this, but I was disappointed when he decides to stab.
It's all for the comedy, which is, I guess, why he went with Matt Dillon. This is not an actor that Lars has ever worked with before. I forget about him. I forget that he was in There's Something About Mary. Like, he's the part of that movie that I don't ever remember.
Yeah, I was going to say, Stuart, like, Matt Dillon. Oh, I can name movies I've seen him in, but he never, like, sticks to me. Like, I don't really recall what his role was.
Do people think he's funny? Is that what you would hire him for?
No, because I think of his, like, 90s film, like, Drugstore Cowboy and...
Yeah.
And Singles. Like, I don't think of him as a comedic actor.
Well, he's kind of funny in Singles. He was the comic romantic relationship in that. But I guess I feel like this movie is a bad joke that you really want to get a like-mind... You want a Peter Sellers. You're about to make tasteless jokes about nuclear war, or in this case, murdering women and your bad boy misogynist reputation. You want somebody that is adept with that as you are, and I've liked Matt Dillon maybe in some movies, but I feel like he's not pulling this off even kind of.
Oh, I like him in this. Again, if you're supposed to come off as a asocial, psychopathic character, yeah, he does that pretty well. Like, when he practices smiling in the mirror so he could show empathy towards others. Yeah, maybe a better comedic actor would make this even better, but I like what he's doing here.
I'll split the difference. I think he works fine as a emotionless serial killer. I do think of Matt Dillon as comedy because I am a huge fan of There's Something About Mary. And so seeing him here, yeah, it took me a while to remember Rumblefish or Drugstore Cowboy.
The Outsiders, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of those other ones that he's done. And I know he has a lot of range, but yeah, I think of Farrelly Brothers. You, me, and Dupree, anybody?
So. Nope, no thanks.
See, that's the thing, is I feel like you do need somebody that's good at that. You do need Sacha Baron Cohen or somebody that is a really devilish, dark comedian. And Matt Dillon wouldn't be, if I listed 100 names, I would have never landed on him. And I don't know whether it's me or just not knowing his work. I just don't feel like he's right for this role.
Well, I think he does good as the emotionless killer. What I don't like is anytime he's not killing. I don't think he pulls off the comedy of, I'm a police officer.
He always feels like a serial killer.
Yeah, I don't, oh, my badge is at the silversmith. I'm getting commendations. Oh, I'm really an insurance guy. I don't think he plays that very well. And I completely victim blame, in the case of the strangulation, that woman let him in the house after all that fumbling about.
Yeah, again, that should be really, really funny, but you have to, you know, Tarantino can tell that joke. There's certain people that know how to do black humor about, oh, we just jabbed a needle through your heart. Like, okay, that takes some skill. And I feel like maybe it's Von Trier. Maybe I'm just blinded by my like with him. His directing chops are not up to par for this comedy. But I don't think that Matt Dillon is picking up the slack either. And so you have these scenes that just come off kind of awkward, that are kind of half smirk funny, but not genuinely funny.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm ever like genuinely like viewing this as a comedy, but the irony of a murderer with OCD, even Von Trier in the script says that's almost ridiculous. Like, even he gets the joke here. But yeah, the fact that this killer is obsessed with, oh, maybe I missed this fingerprint or this piece of blood, and he has to keep going back to the crime scene, even as the cops have sirens outside, like he's not going away. Like, and again, looking at this as a story about an artist, yeah, you obsess over a piece of art and you gotta, like, I've mixed albums and, like, I could spend years mixing one song. Like, I'm never satisfied. Like, I get it. Like, I think if Von Trier is trying to get across that point, he does it very well with this.
I agree. I go with that. I have some of that myself. I have a podcast that I was way too OCD about to ever actually release most episodes of, because they were never edited exactly perfect. But here, I do wish the comedy was playing a little bit better. I also wish this OCD was something that would matter in the rest of the film. It seems quickly brought up and quickly forgotten.
It matters when you think about Von Trier, because Von Trier is full of these kind of tics. To this day, he has these compulsions. I mean, I think that's comedy. I mean, like, we're encouraged to laugh at how outrageous.
Yeah, I think he pushes it to comedic levels, but I think I can have OCD-like tendencies from time to time where I will just go back, like, I'll send an email and I'll read it 30 times for days afterwards looking, oh, did I have a typo? I remember having a typo. And, like, I've read it 30 times. I know there's not a typo there, but I keep going back and reading it. Like, I understand that compulsion.
This should be uproarious. You can't even hear the next line because you're laughing so hard. Comedy. That is what they're going for here. With the punchline being, yeah, the cop shows up looking for a burglar down the street, and he's got to tie the body to the back of the van. He doesn't have time to throw it back in, and he drags it and leaves the whole trail of blood right back to his freezer. And so, again, it's half smirk funny. Like, that's a funny idea. I don't feel like the comedy is pitched as well as a Tarantino or a Kubrick.
Yeah, and then we're going to get a lecture, though. I guess this is his exploration of believing in God, because the rains come down and wash away that trail of blood, and I guess he flirts with wondering if that was divine intervention.
Right. Yeah. And does he want to get caught? I mean, there's Virgil, the Verge, the character is pressing him every now and then, like a therapist. Again, this is like a therapy session of saying, come on, you wanted to get caught. You aren't that dumb. You were hoping that they would haul you away. I mean, that would make you a moral being, right? It would mean that you would have a soul. And so that remains an open-ended question for much of this movie as to whether this character has guilt, has the capacity for love. Is he really a psychopath, or is he just a failed artist?
Yeah, I mean, but this is when we do get that flashback to him as a child cutting off that duckling's foot. It's horrific. I guess he didn't really do it.
No. CGI. I thought it looked pretty impressive, though. As far as pulling it off, I can't not wince seeing it.
The cutting off the leg, I understand special effects. How you got the duck to swim only in a circle like it has one leg, that was what baffled me.
Yeah, I think the gore overall in this film, like talking about it as a horror film, like when he pulls that tarp back from this woman he's dragged for miles and she's just been like sanded down to her skull, it's ugh.
It is, again, I laugh at that one. The fact that she has no face anymore.
No, I get that it's supposed to be funny, yeah.
That was kind of funny. But yes, intermixed in this is some deeper concerns. And again, what did I say about Von Trier? You never know how serious to take him. You never are quite sure if what he's putting forth is just him trolling us or whether he's actually bearing his soul. And that's why people debate his movies so much.
Yeah, during this incident, he also kills another woman. He's trying to pose the one and take pictures, and he's unsatisfied, and he ends up running over a woman walking along the side of the road. I'm not sure what that means for Von Trier. I get for Jack, like, it's just, hey, there's a body, and he's just overcome with this urge, and I guess that random kill, like, gives him more inspiration. He's finally satisfied with these photos he's taken.
Right. I mean, part of it is he's becoming a filmmaker. He took a picture of that woman, the second person. I don't think he took a picture of Uma, but he took the time to get a snapshot of the second victim, and now he's got his own dark room and he's developing them like a filmmaker would. And he's like, you know what, these pictures could be better. I'm going to take the body out of the freezer, still frozen, drive it back to the crime scene and reposition it so that I can get a better shot here. And oh look, there's an innocent woman walking on the road along the way, I'll throw her in here too. Again, this is farce. This is slapstick. All of this, if it were paced faster, which is how you tell farce, is you don't let up. It's relentless. This thing needs to move, 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 90 minutes or less, then you would get that. But because this movie is so sluggish, it's a wet fuse kind of comedy where it takes you a moment to go, oh, that was a joke.
Yeah, get rid of all these philosophy asides and tangents they go on. I mean, I get it. It's funny that he's going to call himself Mr. Sophistication. I did wonder if it was a reference to a very strange character in Killing of a Chinese Bookie, the only Mr. Sophistication other one that I know in film. Mr. Sophistication, no one sophisticated is going to call themselves that.
It definitely is a Cassavetes reference.
I didn't see this as funny, and I'm looking at this and thinking everything would matter to plot. He's sending in photos to the newspaper, Mr. Sophistication. He's gluing newspaper articles to his wall full of vanity. And I'm like, okay, so I think Verge is right. He wants to be caught. He's doing really fucking stupid things.
I mean, isn't this the case with all serial killers? Like, they always, Zodiac killer, just start sending in letters. Like, maybe they just think they're so smart they can't be caught and their ego has just exploded so much at that point. But every serial killer does this.
Not every serial killer. Ted Bundy.
Well, not every, but many.
It has been done. And I think we know about those cases because we're fascinated by the letters. I mean, but for every Unabomber, you get 10 Ted Bundys. But you said cut out all the philosophy and stuff, Jacob. That's the only thing I have to cling on to here, is the discussions of art and literature. And Sean said it took him 5 hours to watch this movie. It actually took me almost that long to watch it because I'm constantly pausing it and looking it up. I'm like, who the fuck is this piano player guy? What is this book they're referencing? I paused, I researched everything so that I could understand the context. That was my favorite part of the movie. The rest of this is a lesser American Psycho.
See, I would think someone that was a real Mr. Sophistication would be able to entwine that with the narrative or be okay with the ambiguity. Be like David Lynch and just go, here's Eraserhead. Make with it what you will. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. Like, I would almost respect that more instead of getting this big, long diatribe about negatives and the dark demonic light and that's going to come back at the end. Like, I agree. Like, these are things I find interesting because I am a process guy and I enjoy that kind of stuff. And I always found negatives creepy as a kid, like the way the lights are reversed and that. But I would say cut all that.
Here's what I will put out. A few things. One, it's very European. This, as American commercial filmmaking, makes absolutely no sense. Of course, you cut all of this bullshit out in the middle and you just make it a crazy farce about a guy that's terrible at killing people and yet somehow keeps getting away with it all. Like, that's a comedy. Okay, we can get Roberto Bernini and remake it in English and it'll be great, you know. But this is foreign. This is a European sense. If you watch Godard, if you watch...
Oh, yeah. I've seen Weekend, where they just have long lectures on communism in the middle of the film.
Right. There is a long tradition that some European and American critics and film snobs and elitists think is a really cool way to make your cinematic points.
You know what my comparison for this was Adaptation by Charlie Kaufman, where, again, it's a process film. It's a movie about making movies or specifically adapting another work of art into film. And I think that one is handled as a Mr. Sophistication, like where it works with the narrative here. Okay, maybe it is just more European, where we're going to step outside and go into the lecture hall and tell you about a piano player and all that. I just wish it was intertwined better.
It feels like he is writing his autobiography, but he doesn't want to be bothered to go to the typewriter. So I'm just going to do it here. And so what is von Trier saying about himself? I think he's admitting that he's a narcissist. We actually have this little moment that's a reference to a Bob Dylan music video where he's got all these cue cards and it's all the things that the press has said about him.
I swear I thought that was In Excess. I had no idea In Excess was doing a Bob Dylan thing.
Yeah, if it were the 80s, he would be doing In Excess.
But it is the 80s. I mean, Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980.
That hasn't happened yet, Arnie. I know it jumps around, but that is...
Yeah, it jumps all around. How the hell do I know when he's making cue cards?
This is happening within the early part. We've been told 12 years. Mount St. Helens is towards the end. That's 1980. So this is right around the time of that 1967 Bob Dylan music video. And again, the point is, these are things that if you go and read all of the negative things written about von Trier, he's impulsive, he's narcissistic, irrational, manipulative, mood swings. He's trying to look at his critics, and what he's saying is, I want more. I'm going to send these photos in, and I'm going to cut out the newspaper articles that call me all those things so that I can paste it on my wall. He is narcissistic enough to need to keep getting bad attention, even though it's unflattering. He would rather cause trouble and piss people off and have his name in print than to be respectable.
Yeah, and I think we're going to get that with incident number 3, because this is the one I remember people walking out of the film and condemning it because of these murders of a family.
Killing a child is tough, and von Trier has done it a few times. I mentioned his first film was about a child killer. Antichrist has a very brutal scene.
Ooh, yeah. Right at the beginning, like, oof.
Yeah, Eric Clapton style, child out the window.
This movie kind of pissed me off, though, because I want to know, as clumsy as he was getting into that woman's house, how the hell does he get a woman with 2 kids to go on a hunting picnic with him? I really needed to see that.
Yeah, I do feel like if you're looking for the whys, like when we get to the 4th incident, like why is Simple dating him? And like, how did he get this woman with 2 children to date him? Because as much as he may practice smiling in the mirror, we never see him being that great at interacting with people.
And this is what I would say to that. Why do people keep giving von Trier attention? Why do people keep going to my films? You hate me. He's really talking to the Cannes film audience. The people that keep asking him to come back to this film festival so that he can create a spectacle and be booed and hated. And so I feel like all of the dumb women in this are really those critics that can't get enough of hating. And I think we live in a social media age where it's not hard for people to understand why you would keep going back and be like, I need to just keep consuming this news that drives me crazy. And I mean, we live in the era of Trump. I'm just going to point it out right here in this scene. What does he do? He hands out MAGA hats to these children.
Yeah, I didn't want to bring up Trump because I'm like, oh, hunters, they wear orange hats. Okay, they're maybe in
no.
The red in Europe. Then I read the comments that von Trier made about this film being inspired by how nihilistic and pointless life is because of Trump's election.
I haven't read that. And I doubt that that's the entire reason he was working on this prior to Trump's confirmed election.
Well, at least that's how he wants to contextualize it.
Yeah, he talked about Trump a lot in interviews about this.
He didn't do too many interviews with this, but he did put as a bonus feature on the Blu-ray, Hi America, I forgive you, don't vote for Trump again. So in case you guys were wondering out there, von Trier fans, which way to go in the polls in a couple weeks, von Trier says go with Biden. And here, this scene is very much drawing the idea, linking the idea of American stupidity with this red hat.
Yeah, you talk about the critics and that. That's how I took it as this family. Like, oh, you want me to make something that's family friendly, something that's commercial? Here we go. I'll give you my version of that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we have, I mean, again, it feels, frankly, we keep having Virgil interrupt and saying, you know, do you expect me to praise this? You know, you're taking the most sensitive subject of children and exploiting it. Why would I be impressed with that? And Lars keeps saying, don't look at the acts, look at the works. This work is looking a lot like Uwe Boll. This looks like Postal to me. This feels like someone that is very happy to take his reputation, wad it up into a ball, wipe his ass with it, and then rub your face in it. This is a tasteless joke film out to troll his haters.
Can I say, though, I kind of respect, at least in the unrated version, the way he depicts the violence, because it is very graphic, very real. This isn't pull the trigger and then turn away from the child's leg being blown off and turning backwards or their head being blown. Like, he shows it, and I kind of respect that he's going to show the violence. And, like, you know, we talk about school shootings and that, and we don't want to politicize it. No, like, show dead children. Like, that might get you to change your stance on something that's horrific.
Maybe, but this also does feel exploitative and shocking for shock's sake.
Totally.
I mean, you didn't have to show it. I mean, and especially the second one where there's like this extra explosion. I'm sure it's CGI. There's no other way to really do that. Because I looked up the differences between censored and uncensored, I got to see still frames of these kids' heads getting blown off. And I'm like, you know, you do you, but I found my line, and that is my line. Anything against people under 18, actors under 18. The actors can play 16, 15, but no, blowing heads off kids and showing it on screen, you got me. You got me to finally feel for one of his victims, because the last two, I'm like, I don't really care.
Again, it's hard for me to look at this as a serial killer story or feeling for victims. Anything that I would say about us, Silence of the Lambs, right? Like, just does not apply to how I'm experiencing this movie. This is, if nothing else, a dreadful deconstruction of a serial killer. There's no way that I could look at it or appreciate it in any way as commentary on why people kill. This is about an artist looking at his art and looking at his failure.
Well, because you're told that right from the beginning and over and over and over. And that's what I'm saying. If you cut all that, you could have someone just go, oh, this is a portrayal of a serial killer. And then maybe there's something deeper there. But because Von Trier is going to have all these asides, there's no way to escape what's being said.
It's a movie where the subtext becomes overt. And you have the critics actually a part of the movie. Virgil is the critic.
We know how well that goes, putting critics in the film based on our opinions of Lady in the Water.
Yeah, but here we have Virgil just literally saying what anyone would be thinking. I'm like, is this because you want a family and you can't have one? Like, that's how we would deconstruct anyone that is murdering children. Is somebody hurt you as a child? You have this desire for love. What? Tell me about your mother. I mean, like, just Freudian cliche is coming off of this film and the way that he's torturing these victims. And Jack admittedly can't build the house. Like, maybe that is the reason why every time he builds this house, it feels empty because he's the only one in it. And so we always see the bulldozer come and wipe it away. And he starts in an entirely different style, which is Lars von Trier's style. He constantly creates a new aesthetic and then says, no, I'm not going to make a film that way again.
Yeah, I do think the most gruesome part of this segment is when he takes Grumpy, the name of one of the brothers here, and like, poses them and like puts wires in his face to make him smile. And when you see, again, I guess that's a metaphor of manipulation your material for a film. But to me, that is the gruesome stuff. The fact that he tries to make the mom give these dead children pie at a picnic.
Yeah, that one was ultimately unsatisfying, but gruesome. And I felt bad for the mother a little bit there. He gave the metaphor about in hunting, you kill the young ones because you want to keep the species populated. That doesn't make sense when you're hunting humans who can go to the police. I would say it's better to kill the mother because the children will be more defenseless. But the picnic scene was... This movie's too fucking long anyway. I would have liked to have gone straight to Grumpy's transformation into post-Smilex Grumpy.
Yeah, I'll put it this way. The mannequin is highly effective. When you see that smile, kind of like watching the duck foot get cut off. I recoil just naturally. It's Lars definitely does know how to shock people, and that's been used to good effect. Here, it's just farting in my face, but that's what he wants to do. But is he hiding his need for love? I think the fourth incident, he talks about that maybe a psychopath, maybe I'm not one because I have these stronger feelings for Jack O'Lynn. Or Simple, as she comes to be called.
Yeah, I don't know why anyone would put up with them. I guess people have all their own issues and stuff and stay in abusive relationships, but he is so mean to her. I guess if this is a response to Cans, it's like, oh, look, you love it when I'm awful to you. Why are you getting upset when I'm awful to you? That's why you invite me back.
You keep talking about Von Trier, and this seems like a bunch of fucking navel-gazing, but as a movie, I need to see this romance occur. I need to see one scene of him being nice to her before he comes over, treats her like shit, and draws lines on her tits where he's going to cut him off. This movie, if you don't know every single aspect of Von Trier's private life, is perplexing.
I question if he could ever be nice to her. I mean, the whole segment starts with him faking an injury with a crutch because it takes people off guard and gets them to sympathize with you.
Specifically what Ted Bundy did, by the way.
Yeah, and I think it's also like Von Trier, you know, when he was making his films about depression, okay, some people just said, oh, you're just faking illness so that we have sympathy for your bad films and your sadism, and I'm not having it. So again, all the criticisms you're seeing and all that you're seeing of Jack are the way society condemns him. Again, we saw no scenes of this character with his mother. I mean, how important would that be to understanding his formative relationships? It's not a portrait of a killer. It's throwing back at critics, this is how you see me. You think I fake my emotions, that I don't have any, that I practice it, and that when you feel things in my movie, it's just a stunt, and that I walk with crutches that I don't need. This is navel-gazing. This is absolutely what it is, Arnie. I can't see this movie as a story. I can't. It isn't that to me.
No, I agree. This is not a narrative. Again, there's a lot of theses going on here. We're going to get a whole thing about the noble rot during this segment. It feels scattershot. It's all over the place. He's got enough ideas for maybe a whole trilogy on its own, but I wish it was more focused.
It was going to be a season of TV. But again, he's boiled it down to all the worst things you could think about.
Yeah, this one is very specifically about his misogyny. I mean, he's going to call out, why is it all men are criminals?
Yeah, exactly. And like the drawing the dotted line and she can't even figure it out. Well, part of what the art is, I mean, I think this is where it is helpful to get Von Trier talking about his art, because he's actually going to bring in clips of his movies at this point, and he's going to be going at a longer digression as we go along about, well, let's just call it what it is. Why do you focus on such ugly, negative things? If you're not a sadist, why do you tell such horrific, horrible stories when art should elevate? When there's a line of thinking that stems from a lot of Western thinking that art should elevate and inspire and be beautiful, why do you focus on putrefaction? And I do think that Von Trier, in this moment, in this segment, really condemns the world. I tell ugly stories because you're all horrible. Because when horrible things happen to people, you don't come and help this woman. You don't hear her cries. You're just as awful as I am.
Yeah, and again, there's a movie right there.
Oh, there's many. We could be doing the retrospective. Melancholia is very much about calling the world evil. And Antichrist, for that matter. But that is where he's at. God is evil. I do what God does. God condemns us to die. All I'm doing is giving them the chance to live forever as a piece of art. And so that is his justification. And of course, Verge pushes back. I love that about Verge. Is he's like, yeah, but are you a good artist? Or are you just a hack that's like kind of pushing through crap and calling it great here? Maybe you're just not good enough for this.
Which I appreciate that Von Trier is at least self-aware enough to know like that is the criticism and that he may be full of shit.
Totally. Yeah. Do not believe that he buys his own line of thinking. He is admitting in this film quite fully, I'm a man full of shit. And it's, I mean, again, it's here, it's on display in many long diatribes. His self-hatred and the reason why he's so clinically depressed are verbalized.
Yeah, and this is where we're going to get a little montage of Von Trier's films. Like, they're going to show us Antichrist and some of his other ones.
I caught that memorable scene of Birth from Kingdom. I'll never forget that, and I haven't seen that in almost 25 years, and seeing it again, everything came back.
Is that more horrific than a wallet made of a tit?
Yeah. And can I admit there is something kind of like, it's maybe just my aesthetic, but there is something really compelling about perversity and horrific things. I mean, I think that part of why I connect with von Trier is that there is something amazing about artists that can hold up putrefaction, that there is a way of framing that. I mean, we'll talk about this again. We're going to get to Seven at one point, and or killing as a seen as a religious act and as a piece of art. I mean, I think there's a long line of thinking and critical writing about the process here, but just as an aesthetic in general, I do find all of these horrible things we're seeing kind of beautiful in their own way.
No, I agree. There's a term, creative destructionism, where to be creative, you must destroy what came before it. And that's how you get new ideas and new art and new commerce. All those kind of things become because some other industry or some other idea was destroyed. And here he's doing a very literal version of that.
Yeah, he can't even resist calling Hitler like a great artist. Like, he's got to go back to that little joke that he told at Cannes that got him into so much trouble about being a Nazi sympathizer. He's doing it here in this film. Unrepentant, I'm going to be as horrible as you think I am.
And, you know, to go back to what you said, I think this is a beautiful looking movie. I like all the camera work going on. I think it's conveying an emotion that the script and the actors aren't. But just taken scene by scene, if I were walking into I went to the Museum of the Moving Image in New York, and you walk in, they're showing a movie, you can stay for part, all, whatever. If I saw some of this, I think, oh, this looks really great. I like the style. I like the aesthetic. But you give me 2.5 hours in this story and not quite so much.
Yeah. You wonder what he could have done if he were a younger man trying to make these points about art in the era of the 90s, in the serial killer genre heyday, when lots of people, including David Fincher, were making this film. Like, that would have been interesting to know. But no, we're seeing an old drunk that hates himself and thinks that his career has gone to shit and fuck you all. So we're getting that in large quantities here. At this point, this movie is exhaustive. We've reached almost the 2-hour mark, and we're headed towards the fifth incident and the climax of the film.
In which a murder doesn't happen? That's kind of a shock. And it's not a female victim. Here, it looks like they're all male. It starts off, he's kidnapped someone in the back of his van. He takes him to the freezer, and we see, it looks to me like all men. Maybe there's women in there. But he's lined them up. He wants to shoot them all through the head with one bullet.
Which is fun. Like, I like to see that he's getting bored with the standard killing. And earlier, Verge did ask him, why is it always women and things like that? So here we finally got to a man. I thought we'd get to a man immediately after saying, why is it always women? It took a while, but we're getting to this 20-something armed services member.
Here's another thing about von Trier. He did create Zentropa Studios. It's a very big deal in Denmark and has been a lifeblood for the film industry in that country. He's had to play the businessman. So thinking about how to kill 7 people with one bullet is a joke about commerce, and one that he's made in other films of his. He had an office comedy called The Boss of It All, where he really went in greater detail about all of that. But that's what he's kind of referencing at this point, that now I have to think frugally. Dogma itself, he had this whole movement of really cheap films, Dogma 95 films that were made on shoestrings, that how do we make a lot of money and make a lot of product for our studio that doesn't cost much? That's what this work of art that he's working on here feels like. But it is a failure. It will not go off, in part because he doesn't have a Full Metal Jacket. He's not Kubrick.
I do think it's funny. It is that military guy that points out that he has a hunter's bullet, not a Full Metal Jacket. I do wonder if that's out of jealousy, because he looks like he's first to take the bullet. So he's like, if I'm going to go, they all got to go. Get that right bullet.
Anything to extend your life, anything to delay, anything to try to make your kidnapper sympathize with you as a human being. Anything you can do would give you more of a chance to escape than he has at the moment, is kind of how I saw that. And I did like the guy at the ammo store. It's an actor I've seen a lot, a character actor. Anyone who watched Lost would know him as Faraday. He was very fun on that. It was interesting to see him play a similar, if less brainy, character here.
Jeremy Davis has done, yeah, he comes from Indies. He's worked with Lars before. And I wish he had actually been in all the segments. If this is a guy that Jack has been buying bullets from for the last 20 years, wouldn't it have been nice to have him be the marker we see in every kill?
Stuart, you took the words right out of my mouth, because this, narratively speaking, okay, I could get it. We're jumping from incident to incident. Why is he with Jacqueline? I don't know, she sees something into him or whatever. But this is where it gets weird for me, because it feels like narratively it's important when he goes to this ammo guy and all of a sudden he's really nervous. Why is he nervous? And then he goes to SP. Who is SP? Why does he have a bunch? Like, this is where I would like a little more background.
The whole movie is failing at this point. Like, the internal organs have stopped working. The heart rate is slowing down. Like, the patient is just dying now. The whole project is just, yeah, who are these people? Why is this happening? What's going on? It's, yeah, it's a complete failure.
And it's confusing. They suspect Jack for a burglary?
That was in incident two, if you remember the cop.
Okay, so that was the incident that they're looking for him because of.
You would, again, if you were trying to tell a normal story and sober, you would weave in the subplot that there is a burglar on the loose throughout the whole thing so that this is a funny punchline that, ah, they got him for the wrong crime.
And why would he run to the place with all the bodies if he's wanted for a robbery that he didn't commit and could easily get out of? Although I guess they'd search everything if they thought he was.
Yeah, they'd see all those newspaper articles posted on his wall.
Yeah. It doesn't need to be pointed out that as a story, this is a total abject failure. Like, it's, I think Lars is happy. Again, I feel like he is destroying his reputation and saying, I didn't build my house. I am not the great director that I've always bragged I was, that I aspire to be, that I promised I would one day achieve. I didn't build it. I tried many times, and this is the last one, and it's shit.
Yeah, is this his summation of his career? Like, yeah, it's just a bunch of corpses. It's not great.
I hope it isn't, because obviously I care about von Trier.
I think he's got some great films. The ones I've seen, well, Nymphomaniac and this one to be disclosed later, but Nymphomaniac, okay, I don't think I quite got it, because I don't know the man's biography, but Antichrist, Melancholia, Dancer in the Dark, love those films.
We'll talk more about where his career is positioned after this film. It's been 2 years, so I know a little bit about what he's working on, and I did see one interview. He's only given one since this time. But in this moment, in this bleakness, I feel like he is in the throes of his full depression. He has never been more bleak and said, fuck it all. I don't even care that this movie's not coming together. And Virgil, take me to hell.
Yeah, the fact that he finally builds the house out of corpses, I guess it's some kind of culmination of what we've been watching. The two parallel subplots of, I can't build a house, but I can kill people. All right, well, let's build the house out of people. Although I disagree with Virgil that says it's workable. That thing looks like it would leak like a motherfucker.
It looks like something they would use in Hannibal, the TV series. I don't know if you ever watched that, but
oh yeah,
they always had these really great, like, how to use corpses as sculpture kind of things that were always impressive. Every episode in the first season was like, wow, look at that structure. But yeah, I wouldn't want to live in it. And again, neither does Lars. This is Lars saying, yeah, I guess all I've done is hurt people. I didn't make my dream. So we get the epilogue.
Which, again, this could sound like a really interesting story, because I think that's, especially for an artist, that is relatable. I think the greatest critic for an artist is themselves.
It's tragic. It makes me so sad to see that these are the conclusions he's reaching, particularly since I have liked many of his work.
I agree. And so I think there is a real emotion there. It's just, it's taken a long time to get there in a somewhat absurd way to get there.
Oh, well, yeah. Again, I'm not enjoying this. I'm appreciating him telling me where he's at. Checking in is what it's called. Thanks for letting me know this is how you feel. But I am not at all happy that this is where you're at emotionally.
But am I the only one who wanted it to just end at that moment? I know he was being taken to hell this whole time. Seeing Virgil personified, okay, I didn't necessarily need to, but that's fine. And then to continue, though, and show us replaying some of the dialogue from earlier as their journey begins and actually going to hell, I wish this movie had just stopped with him entering the house.
What we are in is Dante's Inferno. Again, he's recast himself as the main character of this descent into hell with Virgil, and they're walking through recreations of what's considered great artwork by all the old masters. Some of these video paintings, like you can see with the scythes and all of that, that's a series of artwork from the 18th century.
It becomes very apparent when we get that shot of them on the boat with, like, the people strapped to the bow. And I wish this just went more David Lynch, more surreal. Just have those images. Don't have this dialogue. Just have these crazy images of this descent that they're taking. I would have been way more into that.
What I'm getting out of this is, for von Trier, if not for Jack, he's seeing what greatness is and thus seeing the contrast to his own failure. And then it's kind of funny that I like the fact that Virgil's just like, well, you're actually going to be up in like the sixth cell of hell, maybe the fifth.
Yeah, two levels up. I did think that was funny. He's not the worst thing in the world.
You're not at the lowest rung, but I thought you'd want to see it since you always love putrefaction. You love the worst. So here, motherfucker, here's the lowest rung of hell, this eternal drop of lava of no end. Take a good look. And naturally, again, I think that what I've appreciated about Von Trier movies in the past is that even though he can reach cynical conclusions, there's always a belief in faith. He does try to be that Catholic sometimes. He does try to believe in a higher power and see the optimism of the scene. He thinks he can get out of this. He thinks he can climb to that staircase.
Yeah, there's this bridge that's fallen down. If he could get to the other side, there's a stairway to heaven, I guess you could say.
Sure.
Now, the fact that he is an engineer, didn't you think this would finally pay off? Like, I can build this bridge. I'm an engineer. I know how to do this, that I can cross this gap. Not, I'm going to pretend I'm Tom Cruise and start rock climbing over a chasm.
But I think that is the only thing that this epilogue gives light to, and I don't even know if it's something we needed to know. We saw it throughout, is that Jack is egotistical, that he believes no one else has been able to cross that chasm before, but he believes he could do it.
There you go. The narcissist, Lars von Trier, he thinks he's so great. He's always got to put his name in the press and say, I mean, again, he is proclaimed in public many times, I am the greatest filmmaker in the world. I have always taken that in jest, but his critics have always been like, oh, I hate you. You're such a narcissist. Yes, of course you think that you can do something that no one in the history of the entire universe can do. And guess what? You fucking failed again, Lars.
But did he fail? Jacob, Stuart, do you recommend the house that Jack built? Jacob.
Sorry, Sean, this isn't a Brown Arrow to me. I kind of get into this film. I like a lot of the ideas. I guess it would work better as a TV show because I think there's way too many ideas. Really, you know, focus. Focus. Pick one or two ideas you want to explore. Go a little bit more surreal, a little more ambiguity. Don't spell it all out for me. I wish that was this film. As I watch it the second time, and I got more into it the second time. The first time I was kind of perplexed because I don't have the knowledge of von Trier that Stuart does. So when I go to watch it, it's about the process of being an artist and the struggle and what you go through. And I find that stuff interesting. So there is an appeal here. The fact that it's this kind of messy serial killer film and kind of clumsy with how it tells everything doesn't make it great. And as recommending it, no, this is not a film I would recommend to someone, especially if they haven't seen a von Trier film. No. Go to Antichrist. Go to Dance from the Dark. Go to Melancholia.
Right. God help you if you don't know this man's work and just wanted to see a bloody slasher.
Never go to Dancer in the Dark. I gotta...
But there are other films of his to go to before this one. And if you appreciate all this stuff, you can appreciate this one. But this is not a first-time recommend. Just, yeah, go to this one. So again, I appreciate a lot of the things he's trying to do in this. I just think it's very messy and that, yeah, if he wasn't so caught up in his own depression and his own ego, maybe he could have made a sophisticated film. I don't think this is it. So ultimately, it's a not recommend.
Yeah, I feel ya.
Wow, I thought you'd go the other way with that, Jacob, the way you were talking throughout. So
no, it's a film I don't know if I respect it, but I find things that I like in it.
Stuart.
Yeah, I equate the movie very much to watching someone use the Mona Lisa to wipe their ass. Like, it's a total fuck you film made by a really angry guy who's willing to admit that he now has to lie in the bed that he himself soiled. And that can be kind of fun. The fact that, Jacob, you're like, but I kind of like some of that is there's a refreshing honesty, right? To someone that says, you know what? I'm a failure and I'm going to own up to what I've done.
Again, go watch Adaptation. I think it's a better version of this about a person failing at what they want to do.
Yeah. Again, he is willing to turn his whole life and life story, his biography, into a tasteless joke, giving the world the middle finger. That can be fun. I almost recommended Postal. Just FYI to flash back to that. I almost, for the same reason, said, Uwe Boll, I kind of appreciate you doing this. I did give a pass to Human Centipede 2, so I can go there. I can definitely say a trash, tasteless film is something that I'm going to endorse. But I'm not going to do it with this film. There is no way I can take enjoyment out of seeing someone that has inspired and moved me in the past. I mean, this is depressing. If you're a fan, House That Jack Built is cause for alarm. And yeah, if you've loved any of his previous movies, which to me have always felt like a wrestling match between a cynic and a childish dreamer. Here, the white flag gets waved and the dreamer loses and Lars gives in to all his most nihilistic sentiments and now was willing to say that reality is a rotting carcass. I think you're a horrible monster. I'm a horrible monster. Nothing good can be produced from classic works like Dante's Inferno to one's family or spirituality. It's all a half-completed house that should be torn down. I hope I never agree with such sentiments, frankly. That is so sad. I hurt when I watch this film. All I can hope for is that, remember my rule number one, maybe Lars von Trier doesn't really mean what he's saying. Maybe this is all a put on. Maybe he isn't this depressed and he's just playing to some kind of Trumpian version of himself. I hope that he can bounce back from this. I hope that he can see something worthwhile in breathing oxygen and living among the world. I don't know. I saw that interview that came afterwards. I'm still very worried, but yeah, I can hope for better things in the future, but it's a not recommend for anyone but Lars Completus.
And I came into this knowing Kingdom. I did end up, because to prep for this, watching a little bit of Nymphomania and Melancholia, I watched the whole thing, but I'm not a Lars fan. I was somebody trying to get used to Lars' style before reviewing this, his ultimate film, I suppose, at least at this point. So taking it just as a movie and not as I want to know Lars von Trier's artistic interpretation of his own autobiography, this thing's too ponderous for horror, too pretentious for fun. There's no suspense. Everything's telegraphed from the very beginning. You have no sympathy for the victims, and if Jack's supposed to be sympathetic, that failed too. So the last question becomes for me, does it have something to say? Does it succeed in what von Trier was trying to do? And Stuart, I thank you for trying to explain what you think von Trier was trying to do, because when I'm watching this, I couldn't understand what would motivate anyone to make this film. I couldn't tell what he was trying to do or for whom he was making it. And from what you're telling me, he made this for himself as a very expensive masturbatory exercise. He's this Louis C.K. making Matt Dillon watch him jerk off.
No. He's rubbing his critics' face in shit. He's saying to all the people that have ever hurt him, okay, fuck you.
Well, I'm sure that they don't give a shit because they've criticized him that much. So this is still made for an audience of one. That's him. And so, you know, one thing, though, when I think about what you say about von Trier's making this as a reflection on his career, a line said in this movie is, I don't recommend it, but the choice is entirely yours. Yeah, I don't recommend jack shit about this movie, but, you know, if you like von Trier, fucking go for it. I don't care.
And it's not his worst reviewed film. This went to Cannes. I couldn't believe it. The man was banned from ever going there again, but they made some last-minute adjustments, and he was allowed to show it out of competition. None of the judges would actually weigh in on whether it was good or bad, but it was screened at the Palais, and yeah, 100 people supposedly walked out.
But it also got a 6-minute standing ovation.
Yeah, the people that remained stood up and applauded, and 6 minutes said, we're glad. I mean, von Trier is just, his identity is caught up in that. They did a poll one time in Europe of film critics and film fans, and it's 60-40. 60% said absolute genius, 40% said absolute charlatan. And I think that ratio will probably never go away.
But Sean, what about you? You've heard our review. Where do you weigh in after hearing all that?
We've changed your mind, right? You love it now.
Oh, I always loved it, Jacob. It's a brown arrow. Like it's I can't believe that so many talented filmmakers don't get the chances that this man has. Yeah, I'm stunned. I mean, I think I had the same expression on my face that Stuart did at the end of Face Off. Truly, I just couldn't believe that this movie was made. If I could give some suggestion to screenwriters out there that are listening, let me just tell you something. Not every idea you have is film worthy. Right? You choose things that bring emotion in human beings. I mean, Lars von Trier, you don't have any of that for me.
Oh, I think some of his movies are the most moving things I've had. Breaking the Waves makes me cry.
Absolutely.
I can't watch Breaking the Waves without being emotionally destroyed. Destroyed by that film.
I'm sorry, I can't agree with that, but it's cool. I mean, I've heard what you guys have said. I just don't see it myself.
But don't you realize you're part of it? Like, he is trying to get you. And by calling this an abject failure and horrible, he's playing to you, right? You know you're being trolled.
I see this as basically Lars von Trier's Lady in the Water. And you guys hated that film. Why is this one better? Why is Lars von Trier a genius and M. Night is a joke?
Well, I don't know if I'd call von Trier a genius. I don't know the man's work as in depth as Stewart, but I will say I would consider him more of an artist. I think he, you know, an artist subjective. Like, I get it. I just think he has more artistic ideals than M. Night does. Like, I think this has, whether it's to troll people in an artsy-fartsy European way, or he's really got something to say, I think there's more craft here than M. Night does with Lady in the Water.
I would put it real succinctly. M. Night thought he was making a masterpiece. Von Trier says, I'm a failure, but the world is fucked up anyway. I mean, again, there's a depressing, I don't know how sincere it is. Maybe von Trier doesn't really believe he's awful, but in this, it felt like a confession to not being a genius. I feel like that was what he conveyed with this film. That was what he wanted to say.
And judging by this film, he's right.
But why do people consider this man a genius and love his work? And people like Uwe Boll or M. Night Shyamalan, they're a farce and are ridiculed. What is the difference?
Again, I wouldn't start here. This isn't the film where I feel like you see Lars at his best. I think this is where you see Lars at his lowest, and he kind of turns his whole reputation into a tasteless joke. That's the way that I take it. But in his best work, which again for me is Breaking the Waves, Melancholia, Kingdom, Zentropa, I saw a man very passionate about struggling with the big themes and wanting to do great things technically and spiritually.
And Sean, I'm almost there with you. I give this guy a little bit more respect than I give M. Night, and especially than I give Uwe Boll.
Yeah, that's an unfair one. Uwe Boll.
Well, actually, I think with this film, I think Uwe Boll and Lars von Trier would hang out together and enjoy a pint. I mean, they have similar sentiments, if not similar filmmaking qualities. But having seen Dancer in the Dark and this and some of Nymphomaniac, I mean, I agree with you that I don't understand why this guy is so beloved. I would recommend Melancholia. It was okay. Yeah, I'd give it a recommend. Yeah, sure. It's not a great film, though. It's not certainly one where I feel that person who made it should be lionized in any way. So I may not agree the Emperor has no clothes, but he's walking around looking like Borat in the thong.
I'll say this, art is pretentious, it's about taking risk, or some, not all art, some's about just, you know, painting realism. But some people do respond to that. I know, like, we talk about Twin Peaks The Return, episode 8, still remember the episode, where it's just about that nuclear bomb going off for 48 minutes or whatever. Like, I was blown away by that. I thought it was genius. Other people probably really annoyed that there is no story in that episode. And that is what art is. You take a risk, you have an idea, you throw it out there. Some people are going to respond, some aren't. Again, I think von Trier has more artistic aspirations than M. Night.
And I guess I'd ask Sean, do you like David Lynch?
I like some things. I don't like everything.
You don't have to like Inland Empire.
I do see these two as somewhat similar. And if you haven't seen Kingdom, the TV series, if you like Twin Peaks, the good years, not the Showtime year, maybe check out Kingdom. It might change your mind a little bit.
I'm actually halfway through it. I've seen the first season. And yeah, I mean, people say that's genius, but I mean, this isn't a Kingdom retrospective, but there's a whole bunch of crazy shit that I feel like doesn't have anything to do with the ghost story that I'm just like, yeah, that's kind of interesting. The ghost story is, but there's this whole other half of the show that for me means absolutely, it's just craziness that means nothing.
See, I kind of liked that part. It was like ER meets Twin Peaks. You know, I kind of liked the hospital stuff that didn't deal with the ghost, and then I liked the ghost stuff too. So that's where I can, you know, from what I've seen, where I can defend von Trier as not being total shit.
Well, you guys might get your wish. I don't know that von Trier is going to make another film. He has given the one interview I talked about. He looked very bad in it. His health was poor. He was obviously shaking almost like he had a tremor or something, like palsy.
Well, I don't wish the man dead, and I don't care if he makes another film. I just wish not to see it.
He is sober again, and he was talking about maybe making shorts, which to me felt like, wow, you don't have any inspiration. You don't really want to, like, maybe I'll make a 10-minute thing or something. I'm like, oh. Now, he is doing something. You want to talk about crazy? I had to laugh about this. He has announced a line of custom-made jewelry inspired by all 13 of his films. Starting with Melancholia, you can actually buy a ring that symbolizes the collision of Earth with the Melancholia planet. He's going to do this one. I imagine this one would be, what, like a booby purse encrusted with jewels or something? I'm not sure. How you bring house that Jack built into the diamond industry. But he's taking orders now. He has had a few offers from Russian oligarchs. And if you're interested, you can actually go virtual reality, inspect the diamonds up close to see how they've been cut and how they symbolize the film. Knowing Lars hates VR, I know all of this is just a joke. But again, this is Lars' sense of humor.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm going to place a pre-order.
I don't know. I laughed. Again, at least he's telling a joke. I mean, I think that this movie was so dark about what it was really suggesting about what he thought about things that, yeah, hopefully maybe he can find his muse again. But I tend to think not. He's in his 60s now, and any artist, after 4 decades of work, usually is done.
Well, we're done with this review, but of course not done with Now Playing. We have 2 reviews coming up for patrons next month again. You know, because we hit that milestone, we've been giving patrons of $10 or more an extra review every month. November, it's Thanksgiving. Let's take a second serving.
Yes, first we're going to memorialize the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy with a review that, Sean, you've requested. JFK, Oliver Stone, the 1991 hot-button political drama. I assume you like it? That you're getting it not because you want us to tear it down?
No, it's my second favorite Oliver Stone after Platoon.
Okay, after Platoon. Platoon is still your favorite. Huh? Okay. Well, we were going to be covering that right around November 23rd, and then the week after, just as everyone has gotten together for Thanksgiving dinner, we're going to guess who comes to dinner with the 1967 classic interracial romance comedy, Spencer Tracy.
And then we're following it up with a review of Guess Who, right?
No. Someone's got to pick that short straw and watch it. I've never seen the Ashton Kutcher remake.
Well, yeah, why don't we do Why Him as well? Is that what it was called, that Bryan Cranston?
That movie's actually good, but it's set at Christmas.
Oh, okay. Just in bad boyfriend movies.
Yeah, but this one specifically racism. And Katharine Hepburn. Hepburn Tracy.
Yep.
And Sidney Poitier. I can't imagine a more marquee cast from that period of Hollywood.
As hot button as that dinner was, I feel like Thanksgiving dinners around the country are going to be even more strange. So hopefully we can bring some levity, enjoy that classic movie, remember to ease the racial tension, and yeah, enjoy 1967 film as well as the 1991 Oliver Stone film. 2 films for the November patrons.
And Sean, thank you again for picking this movie. Sorry we didn't see what you saw, but hey, not only did you pick JFK, you're going to be joining us again pretty early on next year to review The Conversation, the 70s noir thriller with Gene Hackman.
The prequel to Enemy of the State.
One of my favorite films, like, of all time, like top 5.
And I can agree with you on that one. That is a film that I'm very passionate about as well.
I believe you said better than Godfather when we were doing The Godfather.
Maybe, yeah. It might be, I don't know, Apocalypse Now. I definitely like it better than Godfather 2.
All right, well, we have a lot to come up, and patrons, thank you for your support. You know, we really appreciate Sean picking all these movies, but it is a cumulative crowdfunding effort that keeps Now Playing going. Every single one of you who's a patron, thank you so much for helping us build Now Playing's house. So until next time, this has been a good day, an excellent day.
It's over now, Jack. What's over? They know what you've done. I'm kind of glad that you're the one that caught me. Perhaps you don't know this, but I think of you as my best friend. Now, that might not be a big deal to you. You've meant a great deal to me. Feels quite nice knowing that it's all over. Somebody had to free me.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign. and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Don't you think we deserve a drink?
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
Are you trying to leave me? I feel like you're trying to leave me.
I'm not gonna leave you. I'm right here, on the other end of the line.
And we want to wish a special thank you to Sean Ray for his tremendous support of our show and for picking the house that Jack built for this patron-exclusive review.
Never make it up to you. Never be able to make it up to you.
If you enjoy Now Playing, please head to iTunes and leave us a 5-star listing. It's the best way to help spread the word about the podcast.
Your great talent only reached so far. You, artist of old times.
You can follow Now Playing on Facebook and Twitter, where we post announcements of new episodes and where the hosts post movie mini reviews. Links to our social media pages are available on our homepage.
You want me to show you the way to the next whiskey bar?
Now Playing Podcast is produced by Arnie Carvalho.
Oh dear, you are a dangerous man.
Associate produced by Jason Latham.
You certainly are clever and tough.
Now Playing is edited by Heath and Arnie.
For thousands of years, human beings have tried to localize hell. Among other methods, by seeking the sound it generates.
Now Playing credits read by Brock.
Hey, talk to me.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
When I think about all the things I've done in my life, without it in any way resulting in punishment.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
Tech plays music, if that's something that your limited brain can process.
Why do you always have to be so cruel? I'm not completely stupid.
That fucking depends on your definition of completely.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
I repent nothing. No matter how long we have to walk.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Your house is a fine little house, Chick.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Picnic's over. You can go ahead. I'll take care of the kids.
Thank you so much for helping us build Now Playing's house. And for the editor, I have one retake because I said rats at the beginning thanks to an autocorrect error in my notes. So let me re-say that line just before we end. Let me find the correct line. This is Arnie, the noble rot of Now Playing.
I was wondering what you were doing with the rat thing. I was like, I don't remember that line.
Yeah, I thought it was a mistake, but I'm like, I don't know, maybe he said rat in there at some point.
Yeah, he says a lot in the movie. I was like, maybe he said it. I don't remember.
Google Docs thought I said meant to type noble rat.